Gresham College presents The Psychology of Performance, Actors and Acting by Dr. Glenn D. Wilson of the Institute of Psychiatry, King's College London.
Well, evening all. I'm Glenn Wilson from the University of London, a psychologist primarily, but I do have some experience as a performer. In fact, I've always had a foot in both camps. One perhaps being more camp than the other, but that's beside the point. For some years, I've been teaching a course on psychology applied to performing arts in American universities and developed a textbook of the same name. It's a sponsor's fine product here for you and carries all the references that you would need if you want to chase up the authenticity of anything that I might say tonight. Now then, actors and acting. It's the second part of the Wilson Ring cycle, if you like, of three lectures in performing arts that Gresham College has very kindly invited me to produce. Actors. There we go. Yes. Actors and the process of acting. Now, theatrical performance generally derives partly from ritual. And this is the stereotype repetition of activity for magical effect. The origins of these activities may be accidental or forgotten, but they become invested with important social or religious meaning. For example, smoking a peace pipe or breaking bread in communion. The functions of ritual are various, but they include celebrating victories, remembering disasters, marking important social occasions, as with weddings and funerals, appeasing deities, rain dances, for example, contacting ancestors, as in seances, or just simply expanding consciousness, as in fire walking or sex orgies. Among the components of ritual ceremony that have found their way into modern performance are chanting, mass singing, coordinated instrument playing, formation marching, dancing, masks and elaborate costumes, and special effects like the use of fire, totems, and scenery. In tribal societies, ritual merges with performance in that there's often a division between the performers, on the one hand, the priests and shamans, as they may be called, and the audience, or congregation, if you like. The performers will assume roles and imitate gods or animals in order to mystify, to educate, and perhaps to entertain. Shamans are witch doctors who specialize in trance traveling in order to make contact with the supernatural order, the gods and the ancestors. And usually they intend to deliver benefits to ordinary mortals. This is a practice that's widespread throughout Asia, Africa, and South America and has very ancient origin. But in Western society, it seems that shamanism has split three ways. We have, on the one hand, doctors, psychotherapists, and practitioners of alternative medicine who perform the healing role of the witch doctors. Then we have the evangelists and priests who supervise contact with the supernatural order. And thirdly, we have pop idols, actors, and singers who crystallize powerful feelings like sex and rebellion. And it's the third group that we are primarily concerned with here. The anthropologist Brian Bates at the University of Sussex is among those who argue that actors perform the role of shamans for our society, bringing a world of imagination and fantasy, an alternative reality, into believable existence. Now, according to Bates, actors are psychic illusionists who harness powers bordering on the paranormal to transform mundane reality into something supernatural. And support from this viewpoint comes from a number of sources. For example, studies that reveal high levels of superstitious behavior among actors. Peter Sellers, for example, being totally intolerant of the color green, which could not appear on any sets that he was remotely involved with. Also studies of the links between dissociative behaviors, things like sleepwalking and hypnotic suggestibility, to theatrical interests. If you like, there is a sort of a histrionic personality type that links the two that I'll return to later. A particular kind of magic that performers need to have at their disposal, to some extent, is charisma. And this refers to the power of presence, or charm, if you like, and depends on physical traits like attractiveness, strength, power of voice, personality traits like assertiveness, and certain other characteristics like zaniness and uniqueness may also be helpful. Russell Brand being a notable zany on the modern TV screen. However, charisma also derives from social and political position. Otherwise unprepossessing people like Henry Kissinger, Prince Charles, or Bill Gates, perhaps, manage to emit a certain degree of charisma that is based more on their position in society than what they as individuals bring to it. Simple familiarity can lend a degree of charisma. Thinking of the examples of weather forecasters that people fall in love with because it's a kindly voice in their drawing room, night after night. Game show bimbos, perhaps. So long as your face is sufficiently familiar, that is sufficient to endow a degree of charisma. You don't have to be likable to have charisma. People who are cold, surly, abrasive, Humphrey Bogart or Margaret Thatcher come to mind as charismatic, though not necessarily likable. They may even be completely psychopathic. Serial killers like Ted Bundy are extremely attractive to women. He got numerous proposals of marriage and a vast amount of fan mail before he was finally sent off to execution. Believe it or not, Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, has women fighting over access to him and in Broadmoor Hospital at the moment. That's what fame will do to you. Perhaps the thing that is most central to the concept of charisma is the trait of self-assurance, which Brian Bates defined as the strength to resist the need to be liked. In other words, you don't give a damn whether anybody likes you or not. That will come across as self-assurance, possibly arrogance, but it will also give you a degree of charisma. An actor's name may be part of their charisma. A lot of stars found it very important to change their name from one that was sort of weak or risible to something a bit more macho. In the case of a man, short and clipped, like Brad Kirk or Clark, or soft and rounded and feminine. If you're a woman, Marilyn or Angelina make good female names. Very hard to imagine that John Wayne would have enjoyed so much success as a Western star had he retained his original name of Marion Morrison. Although it's quite possible that Diana Dawes would have got by as Diana Fluck. There are a lot of jokes about that, which I won't bother you with at the moment. Names that are unusual, once learned, are harder to forget. Laurence Olivier, when he first went to Hollywood, they wanted to call him Larry Oliver, and he held out for Laurence Olivier, which just as well, because it is a great deal more memorable as a name and fits better, I suppose, with the sort of the British gentleman actor that he was, rather than the down-market Hollywood film stars. Gimmicky names. Symbol, the artist formerly known as Prince, for example, is a good one. Or alliterative names like Charlotte Church may be helpful because they're more memorable. Or names that evoke powerful imagery. Sid Vicious or Judas Priest are examples there. They work on this principle of evoking an emotion that is strong, possibly appropriate to the style of performance that they deliver. Another trick is to recycle a name that rings a distant bell. A singer called Rose Marie picked that name because, of course, there was a well-known song, and people would thought, I have heard that name, Rose Marie, somewhere in the back of my mind. Engelbert Humperdinck. There was a singer called Jerry Dorsey who was never noticed very much until he stole the name of a German composer of Victorian days, Engelbert Humperdinck, and whether or not anybody had ever heard of him or not, I don't know, but it was the name was out of copyright, if you like, so Jerry Dorsey became quite well known under that name. So clearly names can be very important. They can make or break a performer. Now, for actors to succeed in their profession, they need to call up a process of identification in the audience. That means that the audience are persuaded, by one means or another, to project themselves into the head of the characters being portrayed, seeing things from their point of view, sharing their thoughts and feelings. Now, they may identify with one particular character in a play more than others. If so, it is usually the one that is either more like themselves or the one that they like more. But they usually also have empathy for all of the characters to some degree. If not, then the writer and or the performers have failed. And you don't have to be virtuous to have people identify with you. Villains are very appealing, possibly because we recognize the villain in ourselves and therefore have more empathy than with the villain than we would care to admit. They do have to be credible, believable, however. The 20-stone soprano dying of consumption, or the 5-foot-nothing tenor who's playing Radames in Aida may have difficulty maintaining the illusion. As far as actor training and preparation is concerned, it's useful to distinguish two major approaches. And they, partly because they often seem to be in opposition to each other and highly critical of each other. And these are, of course, the imaginative approach, typified by the method of Lee Strasberg and his New York Actors Studio, and the technical approach that is often identified with British directors like Tyrone Guthrie and actors like Laurence Olivier. The main difference between the two, to pick out one, concerns the focus attention within the performer. That is, are they immersed in the thoughts and feelings of the character that they are playing so that they, in a sense, become the role that they're playing? Or is their attention located out there in the auditorium looking back at themselves to be seeing it as the audience would be seeing them? That's why they're sometimes called the internal or the external approach. Now, George Burns famously once said that the prime virtue of an actor is sincerity. If he can fake that, he's made. And that rather nicely encapsulates both theories, actually. The imaginative school seeks the grail of true sincerity, while the technical actor seeks ways of persuading the audience that he is sincere, regardless of what he might be feeling inside. The imaginative approach is often attributed to the Russian director Konstantin Stanislavsky, wrote a very influential book called An Actor Prepares in 1936 that is still often read in drama schools. He argued that, one of the things he argued was that actors need to make use of something called emotional memory. That is, they have to recall incidents from their own life that relate closely enough to the situation that their character is involved in or portraying, such that they can carry that emotion from their own past lives into the current feelings of the character. Glenda Jackson once described the strategy, a bit jokingly perhaps, as follows. If I have to cry, I think of my sex life. If I want to laugh, I think of my sex life. Strasberg's method, of course, stresses psychological analysis of the character and leads to naturalistic, but often sort of intense, brooding interpretations of a role. Some of the critics would say inaudible performances as well. The approach is particularly applicable to American avant-garde theatre and the intimate arts of film and TV acting, where very often micro-expressions and a very low level of voice might be sufficient. Among the famous exponents that have been through the Actors Studio are James Dean, Marlon Brando, illustrated here in his role on the waterfront, Rod Steiger, Marilyn Monroe, and Al Pacino. Now, the technical approach grew out of the classical stage of France and Britain, where strong voice and larger gestures might be needed to impress an audience. Now, this school takes a position that it doesn't really matter what the actor's feeling inside, provided that they can trigger the appropriate passions in the audience through their voice, their posture, their gesture, whatever signals that they can produce. Losing oneself in the part, they say, can actually interfere with that aim because basic stagecraft goes out the window. The technical people note that there are all kinds of aspects of acting that have no connection with reality. For example, the need to be heard clearly at the back of an auditorium, cheating out, crossing down stage, positioning oneself relative to other performers so that you enhance the sight lines, so that everybody can be seen from all parts of the audience. Picturization is something which refers to the idea of always being aware of creating a nice artistic balance on the stage so that if you took a photograph of it from outside the proscenium, it would look like would have the balance of a classical painting, with the focus of attention being slightly displaced from the center in line with the golden section mathematics. If you look at an excellently produced television show like Poirot, you will find that if you took a still shot at any point in the proceedings, it would be satisfying as a picture. In any case, realism isn't necessarily valued because theatre is supposed to transform the mundane into something much grander, is the way that they would argue. And of course, the technical approach might be said to be more geared towards the classic stage, towards grand opera, epic films and so on, the big stuff. Among the particular techniques that might be acquired are feedback, where obviously there are procedures like reading the critics, looking in a mirror, having videos taken of yourself, which would enable yourself to be seen as others see you. Modelling, where you observe the accents and body language of suitable models in order to construct a character. Famous instance is the Anthony Scher production of performance of Richard III, where, as detailed in his book The Year of the King, which he wrote in the 1980s, he modelled his part on serial killers and predatory insects, which you can see a little bit of both of those perhaps there. Of course, since that time, others are maintaining that Richard III was a goodie anyway, so it might be a totally inappropriate characterisation, but it was a very memorable one nevertheless. Peter Sellers modelled the role of Dr. Strangelove on a somewhat comic German accent that he'd got off one of the on-set technicians, combined with a knowledge of the alien hand phenomenon, you know, where you sort of lose voluntary control of your own limbs. But that was entirely Sellers building his part out of separate observations. Another interesting example, the film Dead Ringers. Jeremy Irons had to play two twins. He played both twins. One of them, called Elliot, was a very dominant character, and the other one, Beverly, was more sensitive but more submissive. So Jeremy Irons had the problem of distinguishing the two roles. And he said he did it with a single switch, which was that Elliot walked on his toes, with the result that he would have a sort of a forward-leaning, assertive look, whereas, the other way around. Elliot walked on his heels, which brought him upwards and made him expansive, whereas Beverly walked on his toes and was therefore a bit more sort of cringing and submissive looking. Of course, a knowledge of personality theory might be helpful in telling you how different traits of personality will cohere. Psychoanalysis may have something to contribute in showing you how to, for example, portray repressed sexuality by sort of tight buttocked walk. There's one suggestion there. There's no doubt that some element of each main approach is necessary for effective performance. And the argument really comes down to a question of which one comes naturally and which one requires the training. I wonder myself if it is the technical aspect, things like voice projection and stagecraft and so on, that the schools do need to train, or that most need to be studied, because we all have experience in empathy, or what is sometimes called mind reading from childhood, figuring out what's going on in the head of other people, and evoking sympathy from our parents. I suppose there's another model for that, by a little displays of emotion. It's certainly true, as the technical people would say, that feelings during a performance are no use unless they're communicated to the audience, and that communication cannot necessarily be taken for granted. Just because you feel it doesn't necessarily mean that the audience is going to. There are a couple of techniques of the imaginative approach that widely known. One is improvisation, where the characters sort of sit about or run around, getting into the role, manufacturing their own lines. And another one called character analysis, where they do exercise like where were you born, what was your mother like, and all this kind of thing. And they may be useful in the early stages of performance. But in preparation, probably more than the delivery of the performance itself. And the critics say that they can be terribly time-wasting. There's a famous anecdote of a trendy young method-type director who has been wasting weeks and weeks of rehearsal time with various exercises, improvisations, and so on. And the next one he comes up with is, I want you each, one at a time, to come bounding down to the footlights and bawl the most obscene thing you can think out into the auditorium. So first guy comes pounding down and produces a few expletives, and this goes on two or three times, and then the senior member of the cast comes bounding down and says, "We open in 2 weeks." It's apocryphal, although there are some people that claim that something remarkably like that happened with Peter Brook as the director, and Gielgud was supposedly the senior member of the cast. Excessive displays of emotion can actually interfere with audience empathy. If an actor is too demonstrative, the audience may stop traveling, to use the shamanistic description. Rather than engage in self-indulgent emotions, the job of the actor is sometimes just to provide a blank canvas on which the audience can project their own feelings. And sometimes the less they emote, the better the blank canvas they provide and the better the audience are able to project their own emotions. There's a story about Noel Coward, who was directing his own play Nude with a Violin on Broadway, when a very earnest young actor came up to him and said, "Mr. Coward, could you please give me an in-depth analysis of my part?" And Coward famously replied, "My dear boy, never mind the motivation, just say the lines and don't trip over the furniture." It's equally true that excessive technique can be intrusive. Some claim that in watching Olivier's Shakespearean roles, what you very often find yourself observing is a great actor going through his paces rather than identifying with the plight of the character themselves. You know, you're sort of aware of the rolling eyes of Othello or something and thinking, gee, that is great craft going on there, but you're not actually immersing yourself in the role of the character and situation of Othello himself. What sort of people are actors? Well, in their own perception, it's a rather negative thing. This was a survey of 400-odd equity members who were asked, how do you think the public views you? And these were the sorts of perceptions that were listed. And research shows that, indeed, compared with other performers, actors tend to be extrovert, adventurous, and expressive in personality. And a negative construction that is sometimes put on this is that they are exhibitionists. They have an immature need to show off. The Freudians, of course, interpret this as childhood deprivation that is seeking compensation. That is that because their parents didn't pay them enough attention, they're going around effectively saying, "Mummy, Daddy, look at me," for the rest of their lives. On the other hand, there are others would say, the social learning theorists would say that this was all down to early reinforcement for theatrical behavior. So that a child gets up and does a party piece and everybody says, "Oh, how pretty you look and how wonderful you sang that," or something. And it's that reinforcement that is carried on through the rest of their lives. Now, of course, you don't have to think about that very long to realize that these two explanations are directly opposed. Can they both be right? I mean, maybe one's right for one performer and the other is right for the others. It probably doesn't matter too much, because the behavior genetic research suggests that exhibitionism, as with any trait of personality, is very largely constitutional. And that insofar as your parents are responsible for your personality, they are so for the genes that they pass to you rather than the terrible things that they have done to you as a child. Your upbringing is pretty largely irrelevant. Actors have often been accused of being neurotics who are engaged in an attempt to treat themselves in their performance. And that rings a bell, I suppose, especially for the performers that write their own material or have control over it in some way and who reveal repetitive themes. Sylvester Stallone is always the small man who becomes the great hero, Rocky and Rambo and so on. Woody Allen is the geek that impresses beautiful women with his intelligence and wit, wins them over. Which he does in real life as well as the films that he writes, interestingly. John Cleese is the uptight Englishman who would like to break loose from the shackles of his background, become more American or Italian, as you see in films like Clockwise or A Fish Called Wanda, apart from many sketches in the Monty Python series. One could speculate that the Danny LaRues and David Walliams of this world have a sort of a cross-dressing interest that they managed to find an outlet for in their stage performances. I couldn't possibly comment. But I do think that we need to resist the temptation to pathologize excessively or unnecessarily about other people, especially those whose lifestyles we very probably envy. I think this is a problem with a lot of the members of my own profession. They go around seeing little weaknesses and neurotic complexes and so on in other people, and in fact, very often they're having a much better time than they are personally. Just that they've got the jargon to describe them in psychopathological terms. I think I might have just disconnected my earpiece. Not too sure here. Performers probably do crave love, applause, and recognition, don't we all? These are markers of occupational success as well as personal needs, and they might just as well apply to chartered accountants as to actors. There is some support for the idea that comedians are particularly susceptible to depression and that rock singers are prone to addictions, but actors overall are pretty much as mentally healthy, physically healthy as the rest of us. Rates of depression and suicide are not elevated compared with the general population, however much we may be interested when one does top themselves. And in fact, when successful, actors are probably amongst the most self-actualized people in the world. So we don't need to feel too sorry for them. There are some people who say that actors are engaged in a constant search for self-identity, and a self-identity that was never properly established in childhood, perhaps because they had to move house from time to time and had no stability in their background, is what is often said. And the idea here is that playing a role will provide that missing identity for them, which is why they gravitate towards their profession. There are some instances that seem to support that. Peter Sellers maintained that he never knew who he was till he would put on a funny walk and a particular accent. And he always seemed very uncomfortable when he was being interviewed as himself. He would sort of jerk from one impression of a character to another, and there was remarkably little that could be identified as uniquely Peter Sellers. Here again, we find that other people are arguing the reverse, that it is acting that creates the role confusion. There's research, for example, to show that undercover cops and perhaps journalists whose life may depend upon persuading the criminals or terrorists that they infiltrate, that they are who they are, when they have to come back to their previous ordinary life, they suffer something called re-entry strain, which is confusion as to who they are, and find it quite difficult to adjust to their previous life. They have begun to identify with the people that they infiltrate much the same as people who are taken hostage by kidnappers or terrorists will sometimes collaborate with them and identify with their aims. Stars often have roles imposed upon them which they're unable to escape in real life because they have been chosen to crystallize or represent some particular aspect. The simpering blonde, of course, is Marilyn Monroe. The John Wayne is the tough guy, let's move out kind of stuff. James Dean, the teenage rebel. Whether or not these correspond to the real-life character of these people, they would have the greatest difficulty escaping that role because people were perpetually imposing it upon them and resistant to the idea that they might be at all different from that in real life. Soap stars often complain that people they meet in the street will treat them as if they are that character. And even to the point of attacking them physically for some transgression in an earlier episode. that they find unacceptable. And there's a very striking form of identity confusion that's called possession syndrome. Occasionally seen in actors, I don't know how widespread it is, but this is a situation where the actor identifies with the character they're playing so powerfully that they are taken over by it. The role takes control of them. An actress called Mel Martin was playing the role of Vivian Lee in a TV dramatization of Vivian's life. She said she could never escape Vivian at any time. She would hear her voice talking to her, telling her how to play the role, how to say the lines. Charlton Heston said that he was sometimes surprised by the way his character, Queeg, in the Caine Mutiny, behaved. He was the actor, but he said that the character surprised him, as if he had no control. The character was beginning to take him over. Daniel Day-Lewis, of course, a very highly rated and fashionable actor, once walked off the stage in a performance of Hamlet because he said he saw the ghost of his own father, the poet C. Day-Lewis. And it freaked him out completely to the extent that he was frightened to go back on a stage for some time after that. Seems to have got over it at the moment, or at least, or perhaps movies have come to his salvation. A particularly famous case is that of the Brazilian soap star who murdered his on-screen girlfriend because she jilted him in the storyline. Read you the account of this. It was 1996. A young Brazilian soap star killed his on-screen girlfriend in a fit of jealous rage after she jilted him in the story. After filming the episode in which he was rejected, Guilherme de Padua burst into tears and refused to speak to anyone. Later that day, the body of his co-star, Daniela Perez, was found on wasteland near the studios, having been stabbed 18 times with scissors. Witnesses told police that they had seen Padua wait for her, hit her, and bundle her into his car. He was convicted of her murder and sentenced to 19 years in jail. It's a rather tragic instance of an actor over-identifying with his role, and one might say that that is method acting taken to a rather unhealthy extreme. I shall leave it there in case anybody has any questions to ask.
For all information, please go to our website at www.gresham.ac.uk.